Minus number two, his birth. His birth. There were a lot of people had something to do with it, one way or another. And there are only two accounts of his birth, really. One is given by Matthew, the other one by Luke. For the sake of time, I'm not going to give you all the references or read all the passages with you. Most of them will be very familiar to you. They're read every Christmas, at least. And it's not too hard. They're near the beginning of the Gospel, because that's where it starts, with his birth. So within the first chapter or two of Luke and Matthew, you'll find all the things that we're going to talk about tonight. And we will look at one or two of them, but only one or two. So we'll begin. And I will tell you where this is. It's the beginning of Luke's Gospel, chapter 1. It's the second paragraph, and it's God beginning to do something. And he's beginning to do something by doing nothing. And he did nothing for 400 years. Nobody was given the gift of prophecy. No miracles happened. No obvious way in which God was amongst his people or working amongst them for 400 years. And there was a couple called Zechariah and Elizabeth. Zechariah was a priest. Elizabeth was the ideal wife for a priest because she was also descended from the line of Aaron, the original priest. They were morally very upright. They were very diligent about their priestly duties. And they were old. I don't know what you understand by old. When I was 16, I used to think old was 20. 20 seems ridiculously immature from my present standpoint, but I'm not old. So, and I don't know many people who admit to being old until they're at least 80, and yet this man Zechariah admits to being old, so he must be 80 at least. I mean, even Sonny Westbrook doesn't admit to being old, so you know, old is it's getting up there, and his wife is old as well, so think of them both being round about 80. And while they are very obedient and all the rest of it, they have never had a child, which is a source of very real grief for both of them, for three reasons. One reason, it is quite natural for a couple to want to have a child, and particularly so for the wife. Second reason, because the Jews knew that sometime in the future the Messiah was coming, they wanted to have a stake in that great future that God had for their nation. The only way you could do that was by having a family. Third reason, we mentioned a verse last night, Deuteronomy 7:15, which says, if you obey all my laws, you'll not suffer from any of these diseases that you knew in Egypt. It goes on to say this, none of your women will be childless. So here's a promise from God to the nation. If you obey my laws, none of your women will be childless. Now, that was 1500 BC when God gave that. And during the 1500 years, their understanding of it had got bent. See, and they no longer understood it as a national promise. If you as a nation obey my laws, then none of your women will be childless. But they saw it in personal terms. So that if you obey my laws, your wife will not be childless, or you, lady, will not be childless. Therefore, if anybody was childless, they obviously didn't obey the laws. Now, nobody obeyed them perfectly, as we said the other night. Society was divided into sinners and sinners. But since most people did have children, they must only be sinners. And the ones who didn't have children, then they must be sinners. See, so society regarded you, if you didn't have a child, as being a sinner. But the only thing was, there was no obvious public sin in these two, Zechariah and Elizabeth. So the people assumed that it was a secret sin. And they had to live with that. Now, it's bad enough for anybody, it's doubly bad when you're a priest. You see? So they lived with that till they were 80. And Elizabeth was probably married when she was about 15. Zechariah about 20. If you were 16 and a girl and unmarried in that culture, you were definitely on the shelf. It was time to go to computer dating or something. So, a 15, she was married, naturally expected to become a mother. A couple of years went by and she didn't. A little desperation. More and more desperation. Strife within the marriage. Zechariah began to suspect. Maybe her. Wondering if it wasn't Zechariah. Tension. Pressure in the job, etc. People looking at them with funny looks. Very hard to live with. 80 years old. Long past any possibility of natural childbirth. No child. A lot of priests in those days, so many that they didn't often get the chance to function as a priest. And they used to take it in turn. Whole big groups of priests used to take it in turns to have their turn on duty. And when this big group of priests were on duty, then they drew lots to see who would do what. And it might never fall to you to do anything. And at long last, Zechariah's got the chance to burn incense and to lead the people in the evening prayer. And this may be, not necessarily, but maybe only once in a lifetime that came around to him. So he's gone through all this ritual, all this training, bought all his robes and everything, and he's not functioned yet, but at long last he's going to do it. And he's all excited about it, and this is his big day, and he's 85, whatever he is, Elizabeth's 80. And Gabriel appears to Zechariah. Now, Zechariah was not used to interviewing angels. And he didn't quite understand the protocol. It was a little bit of a shock to the system when Gabriel appeared to him. In fact, it says in verse 12, when Zechariah saw him, he was startled and was gripped with fear. Very encouraging for Gabriel. So Gabriel said to him, don't be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard. Zechariah believed in prayer because he was just going to lead the people in prayer, in the evening prayer. And the angel says, don't worry. Hey, your prayer's been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son. You're to give him the name John. He'll be joy and delight to you, etc. And Zechariah was a little skeptical. Why was he a little skeptical? Well, you know, for 65 years he'd been building up his hopes and destroying his hopes and praying and forgetting to pray. And by the time his wife passed the age of 50 or thereabouts and the possibility of natural childbirth was gone, faith went with it. Because really, Zechariah's faith was pinned more on the material possibility than the word of God. Tends to happen. Where's your faith? If the material circumstances appear to contradict what God has said, which is right? Which do you believe? So Zechariah was skeptical, questioned the angel, and the angel said to him, well, it's going to happen anyway, but you're going to be dumb, not able to speak until the child is born. Then you call him John. Poor old Zechariah, a lifetime looking forward to leading the people in prayer, and he can't speak. His big moment's arrived, and he goes out on the balcony, and all he can do is make signs, and he hasn't learned sign language because he didn't expect to become dumb, and he can't communicate. But he does communicate because all the people know that something supernatural has taken place. And God is beginning to do something. He's preparing the people. Hey, I'm still in business. Just because I didn't do anything for 400 years, don't think I've forgotten. Haven't. We're getting going again. And the next thing was that Elizabeth conceived and went to the gynecologist. And here she comes, shuffling along in a wheelchair into the gynecologist's office. What would you think if you were the gynecologist? And as she went into his office, he said, sorry, wrong lady, this is the wrong office. Geriatrics is down the corridor. And she said, I want you to examine me, doctor. He said, what for? And found to his astonishment that this wrinkled old bag of skin and bones was actually expecting. Made the Jewish Medical Journal at least. And then she went to the clinic to do the breathing exercises along with all the young mums. And she became the talk of the town. people knew that God had done something. And Elizabeth puts this in her own word. In these days, the Lord has done this for me, she said. In these days, he has shown his favor and taken away my disgrace from among the people. So the people knew that God had done something. And there was something miraculous happening. Then Gabriel had his second mission. He had to go and talk to Mary, who is not 80. She is probably 14. Not yet married, but engaged to be married. Teenager, sitting at home, minding her own business. That, there is Gabriel. Mary was no more used to entertaining Gabriel than you are. Mary was terrified. Poor old Gabriel. Keeps scaring people to death just by appearing to them. You know, be comforted if you're that sort of person. but I think Gabriel got a bit of a complex because he never appeared again. This is the last we see of him. And Mary is terrified, and Gabriel says, don't be afraid. Now, there is, of course, a supernatural element in this. Angels are supernatural. We don't see them every day. But it was as big a shock to Zechariah and to Mary as it would be to you or to me. It doesn't often happen. Their reaction is entirely understandable and human. They were afraid. Gabriel's response to that is entirely predictable. He said, don't be afraid. It's not bad news, it's good news. And behind the supernatural, which does take us by surprise, that everything is very predictable and understandable. And Gabriel says to Mary, congratulations, you have been chosen. You have been chosen to bring the Son of God into the world. So have you. And Mary must have thought about a few things. There's only one that she said, but she must have thought about a few, like this one. One moment. I'm engaged. Did you know that? I'm engaged. I've got this really nice guy called Joseph. Yeah, he's terrific, great. Mr. Universe himself, and all kinds of other things as well. And he's pleasant with it. And the wedding invitations have gone out. Mother's making the wedding cake. The dress has been ordered. And all my future is bound up in Joseph. Really nice guy, Joseph. Good guy, upright, moral, faithful, great guy. But what is Joseph going to think if I have somebody else's kid? Because I will tell you, Gabriel, he won't want to marry me. He will reason this way. If she did that before we were married, what is she going to do after we're married? No, thank you. And all her future security was bound up in Joseph, but she didn't even mention that. She must have thought about this too. Gabriel, my people have this, you know, terrific, rich heritage, quite a culture we have, all kinds of fascinating traditions. Here's one. If a girl is found to be pregnant and she's not married, they take her out of town and stone her to death. And I don't know what it is, Gabriel, but I've never really fancied going that way. It has never been my life's ambition. As a matter of fact, my mother, Gabriel, is always telling me, don't get stoned. And of course, it is possible, Gabriel, they won't stone me to death because the Romans have taken over and they don't let us do it now. They're real spoil sports, the Romans, and they don't let us do it. But we do it sometimes anyway. Just by the way, of course, Stephen was stoned to death. So they did do it sometimes. More often, though, they would refer to the Romans as in the case of Christ. That is why he was crucified, not stoned. The Jewish way of execution was stoning. The Roman way was crucifixion. So, even if they don't stone me to death, Gabriel, what will happen is this. My family will throw me out. None of the people I love and respect will have anything to do with me. I will only have two courses open to me. One is to become a beggar, the other one a prostitute. She must have thought that. Didn't say it. What she did say was, how? Her father was an Apache, you see. And Hey, Barry's awake. Would you believe it? In other words, she says, I am not a simple girl, as some ignorant people in the 20th century will assume, who doesn't know where babies come from. I do know where babies come from. I also know I haven't done that, but what am I supposed to do? Do you want me to advance the wedding date? What are you seeing here? How? What are the mechanics? And Gabriel said, you don't have to understand. You just have to be willing. If you're willing, God will do it. Beware of people who have intellectual problems and beware of having them yourself. It's amazing the people who have intellectual problems with the gospel. Most of them don't even have an intellect. But here they are with intellectual problems. It is very seldom a matter of intellectual understanding. It is a matter of willingness. You don't have to understand, you do have to be willing. Mary didn't understand, but she was willing. And she said, here I am, I'm God's servant girl, he can do what he likes with me. If that's what he wants, let it happen. And did. Gabriel reassured her and he said, your old cousin Elizabeth, you know old Elizabeth, the old bag of bones over there, 80 years old, she is 6 months pregnant. Nothing too difficult for God. And so Mary went to see Elizabeth. And Elizabeth was 6 months, but Mary was only a couple of days. She didn't send a postcard because the mail service in Israel in those days, or in Judah rather, in those days, was even worse than it is in Canada. You know, forget it. And AT&T were not yet in business. So she just went. And Elizabeth was not expecting her. When she arrived at Elizabeth's house, she just called out, hey, Elizabeth, you there? And Elizabeth came shuffling out, all excited. And Elizabeth knew, without Mary telling her, Elizabeth knew three things. Number one, Mary was expecting a baby. Wasn't apparent. She was still very slim. The days when she would look like a walking barrage balloon were still in the future. Still slim, didn't not apparent. Second, Elizabeth knew that Mary was expecting a boy. You know, there are two possibilities when you expect. No. Third, Elizabeth, a Jewess, strict, moral, upright Jewess, knew that Mary was expecting a baby who was Elizabeth's God. That is an amazing thing for a Jewess to say. You talk to a Jew about Christianity, you tell an Orthodox Jew that Christ is the Son of God, it's blasphemy. God isn't married, how can he have a son? There's only one God. Prayer they recite from Deuteronomy 20, is it? No, Deuteronomy 6. They recite it every day. It's called the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. There's only one God. How can you believe in Jesus and the Father? Not possible. But a Jewess leaped to the conclusion that this unborn child in this unwed mother, 14 years old, was her God. Why? God told her. And she's all excited about it. And she said, when I heard your greeting, the six-month-old embryo in my womb leapt for joy. That tells you something. It tells you that a six-month-old embryo has spiritual awareness. Nothing to do with this lecture, but I thought it was interesting. So, we have the verdict at the moment of three people on the birth of Jesus. They are Gabriel, who says, Son of God. There is Mary, who says, Son of God. There is Elizabeth, who says, Son of God. Now, Elizabeth is the kind of lady you have to respect. She's earned it in a long lifetime of upright moral living. She's a very respected lady. Mary is in the best position of anybody to tell you who Jesus is. If there is one person who ought to know who the Father is, it's Mary, isn't it? I mean, if Mary said that he was just a man, the atheists would believe it, wouldn't they? So Mary's evidence is very important. Mary says he's Son of God. And Gabriel says so as well, and he's a reasonably reliable sort of a witness. So we've got three people's opinion now. We'll think on about Joseph. Because Joseph began to notice that Mary was putting on weight. And Mary didn't say anything to Joseph. She's an amazing person, Mary. Didn't say anything to Joseph. But Joseph began to give her little lectures about chocolates and potatoes. And he said, that wedding dress is going to have to be reordered if you don't watch it. And then a horrible day dawned when Joseph realized that the increase in Mary's girth got nothing whatever to do with chocolates and potatoes. And he thought it through, didn't discuss it with her. But he came to a very obvious conclusion for a man like Joseph. He's not going to marry her. If he's not going to marry her, he's got two courses open to him. One is to denounce her publicly. The other one is to privately call off the wedding. If he denounced her publicly, there would be a big scene. Be very embarrassing for everybody involved, very humiliating for Mary, and not too comfortable for himself. If he did it privately, he would spare her as much as he could spare her, and her family too. And predictably, of a man of Joseph's nature, he decided on the second course and to call it off privately. But as he decided in his own heart to do that, God revealed to him that Mary had not been faithless to him, but was pregnant with the Son of God. And that Mary was pure and that she was faithful. And Joseph adds his unspoken testament to the birth of Jesus by going ahead and taking Mary as his wife, even though they were not married when she conceived. And so add into that Joseph, and Joseph's record, while he doesn't actually say so, is also important because he ought to know. And he's the kind of man, again, who is a believable sort of a man. He is not a man of no character. So then, there's a little bit of organization. The Jesus, as he was growing up in the womb of Mary, suddenly had a thought. And he gave her a gigantic kick from inside, and he said, Mom, you're in the wrong town. You're supposed to be in Bethlehem. Get over there. Well, not quite. But God arranged it. The prophecy was that he'd be born in Bethlehem. Of course, they didn't live there. They lived in Nazareth. Why'd they go to Bethlehem? Because God arranged it through the Roman governor. Easy enough, if you're God. So they had to go to Bethlehem. And as they got to Bethlehem, the angels appeared. Well, the baby was born in the stable. The angels appeared to the shepherds. So now you must add what the angels said. Unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord. Well, add the shepherds. The shepherds left their flocks. And that was a big risk. Under normal circumstances, they would never abandon their flocks, particularly during the night. But they abandoned them, and they went to Bethlehem, and they saw the baby. Now, men don't usually get excited about babies. No, some do, maybe if it's their own. But generally speaking, men don't go all that big on babies. Girls do, they sort of goo and coo and drool and dribble and all kinds of things over them. But guys don't. And yet, these shepherds returned from seeing the child just full of delight. They were singing, praising God, and having a right old hallelujah time because they had witnessed God's miracle in this respect. And so add in the testimony of the shepherds. They told a lot of people about it. And then probably in sequence, the next thing that happened was that they took Jesus into the temple to dedicate him. Every firstborn male had to be dedicated. And if you were wealthy, you brought a lamb. If you were not wealthy, you brought two pigeons. Joseph was not wealthy, so he brought two pigeons. But Mary and Joseph took Jesus at the age of 8 days into the temple. And there was an old man there called Simeon. Simeon had been given a promise by God. And God had said to him, "You will not die, Simeon, until you have seen the Messiah." Now, God did not tell Simeon what form the Messiah would have. And Simeon probably thought what everybody else thought, that the Messiah was some magnificent military figure riding on a white charger into Jerusalem to deliver the people from the power of Rome. And Simeon's old now. He's about ready to die, except he's not ready to die because he's still not seen the Messiah. And then this poor couple come in, bringing a child, a couple of pigeons to dedicate him, something that probably happened every day of Simeon's professional life. But when Simeon saw this baby, he knew that this baby was the Messiah. Mary didn't tell him, Joseph didn't tell him, but God did. And he said, "Hallelujah! Swing low, sweet chariot, coming." I knew we should have sung that. You were right, Barry. "Time to go home." Actually, he said, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, according to thy word, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation," etc. But he's ready to go home, ready to go to heaven. So now you've got the testimony. Again, a very important man, Simeon. He's a really good man. He's too old to jump to sudden conclusions. It is the longing, the desire of all of his life for this to happen. Not likely to make a mistake, and now he has. Then in came Anna. It's old people's night tonight. Anna is at least 104. NIV gets a little bit wrong. But she is at least 104. She's a prophetess. Moved by the Holy Spirit, she came into the temple and the sanctuary at that time. Actually, she never left the temple. Probably didn't have the energy. Says here she was very old. She'd been married for 7 years and she'd been a widow for 84 years. NIV suggests slightly differently, but it's, I think, inaccurate there. So she was married at 15. She was married for 7 years, that's 22. And 84 years a widow, that's 106. Definitely ancient. Anna came shuffling in there, took one look at the baby, and she said, "Hey, that's the Messiah!" And she shuffled on out again into Jerusalem. And she spoke to everyone who was looking forward to the coming of the redemption of Jerusalem. That's Luke 2:38. So add now the testimony of Anna. Probably next in sequence are the three wise guys. And they are scholars and students of the stars. Probably not astrology, but students of the stars. And they've seen this big bright star. It's kind of difficult to arrange those, especially when you've just been born. But anyway, they saw this big bright star, and the star convinced them of the birth of a king. From its location, they knew that it was over the country of Judea. So they set out for Judea, and they arrived there. Now, there was king of the Jews at that time, a guy called Herod, who was known as the Great. Not the greatest, that was Muhammad Ali, but he was a similar sort of character. And he had established himself a reputation. Great had to do partly with his circumference. He was a very fat man, but more to do with his influence. And he was king of the Jews, which was a difficult position to maintain. If you're going to be king of the Jews, you had to please the Jews. And it was difficult to please them because they were religious. They knew how to do it. He gave them money. That usually pleases religious people. And he caused to be built a couple of synagogues. See? And even a temple. Of course, they had to call it Herod's temple. No use building a temple if they don't know who built it. If the reason you're building it is so that people will know you're on their side. So Herod has established himself with the Jews, and the Jews are content to let him rule. But he has to establish himself with the Romans as well, because they held the real power. So Herod also knew how to please the Romans. When he was with the Romans, he said, "Don't assume that I'm one of these ridiculous fanatical Jews. I don't believe all that nonsense. I just go along with it because it's politic to do so, but I'm a man of the world and I understand how things are." And he knew how to behave himself both with Jews and with the Romans, because he didn't really belong to either of them. You're not like that, are you? And the one thing he was determined to do was to hang on to his throne at all costs. And anybody who ever looked like a possible rival or threat to the throne was found floating the wrong way up in the river in the middle of the night. And there were approximately a total of, well, at least a total of 3,000 people who ended up that way, including Herod's own aunt, his own cousin, and his own nephew. Nice man, Herod. But he was going to hang on to the throne at all costs. Now, you should compare yourself with Herod a little bit, because your life is like a kingdom. And all the decisions that you take affect other people. See? You have an effect, for instance, on your parents. You either please them, frustrate them, drive them to distraction, or make them laugh, or make them mad, or whatever you do to them. But you have an effect on your parents. You have an effect on your roommates, whether you keep them up all night or bore them to tears. You even have an effect on the people who teach you. Did you know that? Should stand up here sometime. You have an effect on the people who teach you. You either inspire them to teach well, or you make them think, "What on earth am I doing in here? Why do I bother?" See, so if you must go to sleep, then do it. But paint some eyeballs on top of your eyelids and look interesting. At least the rest of the class will benefit from it if you don't. So you have an effect. It's like a kingdom. And Herod was going at all costs to maintain the throne. He was going to be king. We meet him one morning early for Herod. It's only 10:30 and he's up already. And he's not very well this morning. He's got a headache because he drank a bit too much Coca-Cola the night before. And the hair is all over the place and the yellow stuff's still in the corner of his eyes. And of course, and he's sitting down with a cold compress to the back of his neck, toying with the imperial cornflakes, when in comes a little messenger, bows 27 times and says, "Excuse me, Your Majesty, there are some scholars to see you." "I don't like scholars." "No, Your Majesty, we all know that. Only these scholars said something about a new king." "What?" Cornflakes blew in all directions. "I'm king here." "Yes, Your Majesty, we all know that." "That's why we thought you might want to see them." "Right, show them in." So Herod interviewed the scholars who told him about the star, told him it was a sign of a king. Naturally, they'd come to the capital city, Jerusalem, and to the palace. Where else would you find a king? Herod says, "Not here. I'm king here. But there is some tradition of our people that there is to be a special king born sometime. I suppose that could have happened. I'm not too interested in those sort of things myself. I could find out for you." So he summons one of his scholars who says, "Who, Your Majesty? I thought everyone knew that. Micah chapter 5, verse 2. Bethlehem." Don't get the wrong one. There are two. "Bethlehem Ephrata." Right. Well, there you have the message, gentlemen. Bethlehem Ephrata. If it is indeed the new king, that's where you'll find him. So, perhaps you would do me this favor. After you've found him and you know exactly where he is, perhaps you would come back and tell me precisely where I can find him too. And then I also can go and worship him with a sword. Prosperous journey, gentlemen. So the wise men set off. When they reach Bethlehem, the star reappears, guides them precisely to where the child is. And they go and they worship him, and they bring him the usual gift of a bag of diapers and a rubber duck and a rattle. And it was gold and incense and myrrh. What's that all about? Gold's the gift for a king. Incidentally, I don't know whether it's so elsewhere, but in Great Britain, only the queen is allowed to wear solid gold jewelry, 24 carat. Incense is something you burn to a god. It's a picture of a prayer going up to heaven. It's supposed to be sweet smelling and please him. What is a baby going to do with incense? Well, he's going to make little Apache smoke signals in his cup. And myrrh is the chief spice used in the making up of anointing ointment for a dead body. Embalming ointment, I should say. So, the gifts are a little unusual. Gold, incense, and myrrh. The gift for a king, the gift for a god, and something to do with death. And because they were wise men, they were instructed, really by God, they knew that this baby, or newborn infant, was their king, although it's from a different land, their god, and that there was something very important about the way he would die, and they wanted to be involved in that. Warned of God, they did not go back to Herod. Herod realized he'd been fooled, just too late, ordered his troops to Bethlehem. They found an empty town. Well, they didn't, but Jesus had gone. But they surrounded the town during the night. First light of the early dawn, they moved in, covered every street, every house, every room. Any boy 2 years old or less was taken out into the streets and butchered. Streets ran with the blood of the infants, the town filled with the screams and wails of the parents. Herod was going to keep his kingdom. We need to add in the testimony of the wise men, the testimony of Herod, who took it seriously, and the appearance of the star, and as far as I know, there's one person only able to organize those as he wants them. And so this is God's birth announcement. You know, maybe you've had through the mail a little card which has told you that friends of yours have had a baby. Well, God didn't do it that way. He just sent a star instead. It was a little more impressive. God was excited about the birth of Jesus. So all those people then, Gabriel, Mary's mother, Elizabeth, his aunt, Joseph, his legal father, the angels, the shepherds, Simeon, Anna, the star, Herod, the wise men, all tell us the same thing. Jesus is the Son of God. If everybody tells us the same thing, there's only one logical conclusion you can come to. You can opt for another conclusion, but it's not logical. It's not based on evidence, just on prejudice. If the atheist believes that the 4,000 million people in existence in the world at the moment are all an accident, you know, what's the big deal about one more? If 4,000 million can happen by accident, surely another one can. Mary was not married. Jesus had no human father. I should have mentioned, didn't, the two ancestors given by Matthew and by Luke. Matthew gives the line through his father, Joseph, who is his legal parent. In Jeremiah chapter 13, the house of Jeconiah, the king, is cursed. And the Messiah cannot physically descend from Jeconiah. Joseph is physically descended from Jeconiah. Jesus is not. He's only legally descended from Joseph. But it was legally necessary for Jesus' legal father to be of the royal line. Luke gives Mary's line of ancestry, which does not come through Jeconiah. It comes through the other side of the Jewish royal family. And Jesus has a physical claim to royal blood through his mother, which is the uncontaminated line, not through Jeconiah. Through his mother, then, he has a physical claim to the throne. Through his father, he has a legal claim to the throne. Now, you're either going to be like Mary or like Herod. You may want to hang on to your little empire, and Herod had it absolutely right. In any kingdom, there's only room for one king. But Jesus was born king of the Jews. He was born to be king in Herod's empire. And either Herod had to get off the throne and let Jesus rule, or keep it himself. He opted to keep it himself. But just as Jesus was born to be king in Herod's kingdom, he was born to be king in your kingdom, and to take over the rule of your life. And in any kingdom, there's only one king, either it's you or it's Jesus. Who is it? Who really takes the executive decisions in your life? Who do you think would have made a better king, Herod or Jesus? Who would make a better job ruling your life, you or Jesus? It's going to affect all the people whose lives are influenced by yours. Who would make the better king? Second, Herod wasn't really king at all. He was a puppet. He was only allowed to rule as long as he pleased the Romans, who held the real power. And if you think you run your own life, you don't. There's another power, a dark power, an evil power, that actually rules it, allows you to play at being king as long as you give him no trouble. That's why you can't organize your life the way you know. Sometimes you'd like to, and you ought to. That's why some of your highest resolutions come to nothing. That's why you can't break some of the habits you'd really like to break. You don't really rule. But Herod managed to hang on to it for about another 4 years, died of cancer of the stomach, and went to hell. And if you want, you can hang on to the throne of your own life. The only thing is, if you do, of course, you're not a Christian. See, there are people who would suggest to you that you can be a Christian without having Christ as king. That's not true, because heaven is a kingdom. Right? Seek ye first the kingdom. What's a kingdom? It's where the king rules. The king doesn't rule in you, you're not part of the kingdom. Whatever decision you may have made, whatever form you may have signed, whatever church you may be a member of, if Christ isn't king in your life, you're not in the kingdom. And anybody who told you you were did you a disservice. And when you present the gospel to other people, don't ever mislead them into thinking they can become a Christian without submitting to Jesus Christ. They can't. It's not scriptural. Or you could be like Mary. What did Mary do? She brought Jesus into the world, and that's what you've been chosen to do. You haven't been chosen just to believe a few academic theological facts and join a religious club. You've been chosen to bring the living God into the world, that he might get out of heaven and live in you and through you, do the tremendous things he wants to do in the world around you. But you might say, just a minute, I've got my plans made. You know, I'm not going to marry Joseph, but I've got my plans made. You know, when I leave here, I'm going on to such and such a school, and I'm going to buy a nice house in a particular town, and I've got all the sorts of plans and ambitions. And that mightn't happen if Jesus takes over my life. No, it might not. Listen, I don't think they would stone me to death in Chilliwack, but I can imagine people getting pretty upset if Jesus was really let loose in my life. He managed to upset plenty of people in his own time. And my people aren't that much different. If Jesus really was let loose in my life, all kinds of things would happen, and I'm sure I wouldn't be universally popular. You're right. You won't be. Listen, how? I don't understand. How can he live in me? You don't need to understand. You do need to be willing. You willing? Plans to be upset? Necessary to be very unpopular and misunderstood? But for Christ Himself to get out of heaven and live in you and through you do those things that only He can do in whatever part of the world He takes you to. Because the adventure of being a Christian is this. It is being the link through which Christ makes contact with a particular scenario in which you happen to be. And that will shift several times every day. It may go round and round the world. Or it may stay in a localized community. But whatever the scenario, you are there in that scenario so that Christ can make contact with the people who are there through you. You've been called to bring Christ into the world. That's what a Christian is. Do you want to be like Mary or like Herod? You could send them both a postcard if you like and ask them whether they thought they made good choices. Send one to Mary, that'll go to heaven. Need an asbestos one, send Herod. Find out what they think. But one or the other, you're going to be like one of them. Take your choice. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for all these people involved in the birth of Jesus. Thank you that they speak with one voice, and they're the people who should know, if anybody should know. His mother should know, his father should know. People like Simeon, Elizabeth, Anna. Lord, thank you that you've sort of told us again and again through the miraculous birth of John the Baptist.